homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Can you hear my little foghorn? All right. I sound a bit hoarse. I don't really feel like a horse. I feel more like a schnauzer at the moment. But we'll do our best. So what happens when you get over-enthusiastic with mantras and quatses and this sort of thing? So, occupational hazard. I'm going to be taking a brief hiatus from the awakening of faith today to talk about something that began to suggest itself to me the day that we took the precepts during the retreat. We renewed the precepts. The Founders Day offertory that you heard today speaks of Indra, one of the Brahmin gods of India, pointing a blade of grass at a spot on the earth and a magnificent temple springing up on that very place. This clearly speaks of the, albeit miraculous, creation of a temple from nothing, seeming nothing, or the creation of a place in the realm of time and space for the purpose of training, Buddhist training. Creating a place for training is creating a place for enlightenment. And it is sanctifying a place, a location in time and space, the creation of a sacred space from seeming nothing into something, into a place where enlightenment can be realized. This monastery is that kind of a creation. Albeit it was begun by nature itself and was later turned into a motor hotel and then into a religious foundation, in a much less dramatic way, but nevertheless, just as the offertory said, one day a true seeker of the way came here, looked around, and said, "It's here. This is where we will do it." This monastery is this kind of sanctified creation that came about through the wishes and intentions of Koho Zenji, our founder, whose day we are celebrating today, and the carrying through of those wishes and intentions by Reverend Master herself. In celebration of Founders Day, I'm going to call this intention, or these wishes, the Founder's Vow. The creation of a place for training involves the meaning of two Buddhist ideas which are used interchangeably. And because they're used interchangeably, they're often confused with each other. And like anybody else, we Buddhists tend to use them loosely. But these are the ideas of Bodhimanda and mandala. Both of these ideas have to do with the creation and expression of something that is sacred in terms of time and space, location. They have to do with a place which is both geographical and spiritual. But this place is very important and very special because it is in this place that enlightenment takes place. Not just the enlightenment of one being, but the enlightenment of all beings. Bodhimanda and mandala, where the Buddha nature literally manifests itself. Now, a bodhimanda in Japanese is called a bodai dojo. And it refers very, very specifically to the place where Shakyamuni Buddha realized enlightenment. The Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya in India, the ground that surrounds that tree. That was Shakyamuni Buddha's Bodhimanda, the place of his enlightenment. It is also a place where a Buddha is worshipped. So we can say that we are sitting in the Bodhimanda of Shasta Abbey because our Buddha image on the altar is our main statue. And that is the place where we, quote, worship the Buddha. Worship is not the term that I would look for, but it's perfectly okay. Where we express our gratitude, express our veneration to the Buddha as an object of worship. We take refuge in the Buddha's enlightenment when we pay our respects to the Buddha that's sitting on the altar. Not because of the physical presence of it itself, but what that presence represents. And in fact, if one takes the idea of the Bodhimanda to a deeper place, this is where the enlightenment of the Buddha manifests itself. So our statue is just a statue. And it's more than a statue. A Bodai Dojo is also a holy place of learning where people practice the Buddhist way. And certainly our temple is indeed just that. It is a Bodhimanda for practicing the way of the Buddha. And in fact, any place where people are practicing the way of the Buddha, be it in a temple or in someone's home or out under a tree or within you when you're walking down the street, when you're training, you are a Bodhimanda of the Buddhist way. And the fourth meaning of Bodhimanda is the place of precepts. the place where the precepts are taken, the place where the precepts are given, and the place where the precepts are practiced. All of these come under the meaning of Bodhimanda. There are, to further complicate it, we're also, most of us are familiar with the term mandala. And there are actually two different types of mandala. In Japanese, a mandala is also called a mandara, or another reading of the character is dan. And it literally means a platform. A platform where a Buddha is placed and reverenced, where holy implements are put, and where offerings are arranged and made. In Japanese, this kind of altar, the big altar, is called a sumidan. A sumidan means a Sumeru platform. Sumi is the word for Sumeru, dan is platform. This Sumeru altar represents Mount Sumeru in the ancient Indian Buddhist geography, upon which a Buddha, at the very top of which the Buddha stands, because the Buddha stands at the highest point of the world. Sumidan, Sumeru platform, Sumeru mandala. In India, in the old days, the mandalas for practice were usually created on the ground, and they would be set up for 7 days, and then they would be disassembled. It's interesting to note that when we do retreats in our tradition, we do them for 7 days. And also, if you are ever the fortunate person to see a Tibetan Buddhist do a sand painting, they set up a place, they do a sand painting, and at the very end of it, it is swept away. So it is set up, and then it is taken down. In Japan and China, they used to do this with wood. And you can see the progression of from the idea of impermanence to, well, in certain circumstances and in certain places, it would be nice to have a more permanent mandala. So we'll set it up here on this mountain or there in this place. And temples grew up around mandalas. So again, you have the idea of the Bodhimanda and the mandala, the platform that is created around it. Human beings being what they are, well, here is our mandala, our platform. While we are attending to our mandala and doing our practice, we're going to need a place to eat, and we're going to need a place to sleep, and we're going to need a place to go to the bathroom. And, you know, let's have another, put a smaller mandala here and there. And so it, you know, it all grows up in this way. So a Buddhist temple is a place where a mandala is enshrined. This is our mandala. This is our main mandala here at Shasta Abbey. A mandala, which in Tibetan Buddhism is called a tanka, is a diagrammatic representation of a Buddha, a bodhisattva, or a sacred being, like a great teacher. It represents the body, speech, and mind of a Buddha, bodhisattva, or sacred being. This is what is expressed on a tanka. Usually, well, I shouldn't say just on a tanka, because it can be on any real depiction of a Buddha, bodhisattva, or a sacred being. And there are usually three types of mandalas. There's a mandala of form, which depicts the physical body of a Buddha, bodhisattva, or sacred being. Although we refer to it as a painting, I would call that painting up there a form mandala of Reverend Master. These are form mandalas of Koho Zenji. You can also have what are called speech mandalas, which are, strictly speaking, representations of mandalas in the form of what are called seed syllables. And these seed syllables are the old Siddham script of Buddhism, which express religious truths, religious words, in single syllables. The character Om is the most famous one, but there are actually 52 of them in the old Siddham script. And occasionally, not very often, but occasionally, you actually see diagrammatic representations of seed syllables. Another way of expressing the same thing is what we commonly call Zen calligraphy, where you have a character expressing religious truth, or a certain number of words, a poem, and that's what you have. That becomes an object of contemplation. That's also a speech mandala. We have them both in Buddhism itself, also in the Western religious calligraphic tradition. And there is the mind mandala, which it expresses itself in pictures. The picture of a lotus would be a mind mandala, or a dharma chakra, or a vajra, because each one of these expresses religious truth through a picture. Most tankas, or most religious pictures in Buddhism, are a combination of form mandalas and mind mandalas. Most of them are pictures with a Buddha, bodhisattva, sacred being, a group of them, their arrangement, and all the things around them expressing an important religious teaching. These are all mandalas. But we tend to toss the term mandala around quite a bit and confuse it a bit with this idea of bodhimanda. And in terms of the founding of a temple, there is the creation of a bodhimanda and the setting up of a mandala. And in this creation, in this place, both of the ideas fit together very nicely and mutually express each other. In the offertory, Indra points at the earth, and a temple springs up on that spot. It's a beautiful story. I have never tried it myself, but if I were to go out and take a blade of grass and point it at the earth, I would be very surprised if I got a temple coming out of the ground. I don't have a whole lot of faith in my ability to create that kind of a thing. However, in the world of birth and death, what creates a sacred space or a sacred place is what I will call the founder's vow. And the founder's vow essentially means turning away from the ways of the world, from the ways of greed, hate, and delusion, and turning towards compassion, love, and wisdom, turning towards enlightenment, turning towards the Buddha mind through the practice of Sangha in keeping the precepts. The turning away from greed, hate, and delusion, the cleansing of oneself, Sangha, and the vow to realize the truth, to become Buddha, to behave like Buddha, is the keeping of the precepts. And that is what sanctifies the places where we train ourselves. A temple is a place for Sangha, and it is a place for the precepts. All who live in the temple should be living by the precepts. All who come to the temple live by the precepts when they stay in the temple. A temple should be a place that gives the precepts, or perhaps more accurately, generates the precepts, so that when a person comes in, they renew their vows in the precepts, and then they take those precepts back out into the world. That temple can be a place just like we are, and it is also your own body and mind. Because every time you sit still in meditation, and every time you vow to keep the precepts, you sanctify body and mind. You go into the holy place within yourself, where the place where the Buddha resides. You take refuge there, and then you bring that place forth and manifest it in this world. This is the Bodhimanda, or the mandala of your own body and mind. Just as it is important, or just as important as it is to keep the precepts, how we keep them is more important. Because it's in the how, the attitude of mind with which we keep precepts, that the action of mind of keeping is created. And if we can create the proper, right action of mind, we can keep the precepts. We can purify ourselves. We can become Buddha. What was occurring to me during the renewal of vows the other day was the fact that the Sangha is the community of those who take the precepts. That was the original idea behind Sangha. It was a term that in the beginning of Buddhism was reserved only for monastics, because only monastics took precepts. Usually when you were a lay person, you took the three refuges, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. In fact, you did that too when you became a monk. But as time went on, the Buddha had to become much more specific about what it meant to be a Buddhist, to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So he and the community at that time created precepts, vows of training for monks and for laity. And this community of male and female monks, male and female lay trainees, makes up the four classes of the Sangha. And the Sangha are those who keep precepts. Whether those precepts are 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 precepts, 253 precepts, 348 precepts, doesn't matter. They're all part of the Sangha. As a lay person, depending on what tradition of Buddhism you're in, you take 5, 8, or 10. The 5 are killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and what am I missing? Intoxicants. Right. Intoxicants. The other 8, or the 8 precepts, usually come from Theravada Buddhism, and they involve not sleeping on a raised platform, not using money, and one other. And then the 10 precepts add 2 others to that in the Theravada tradition. In the Mahayana tradition, you have the 10 that those of you who have taken precepts take. And believe me, generally speaking, those precepts are fearsome. They are the precepts of novice monks. That is where the Zen tradition starts with people in terms of the precepts. For the laity, most people do not take as many precepts as you all take. And they don't necessarily take the same kind of precepts, because these precepts are generally regarded as hard to keep. And the reason why they are so hard to keep is that they address all of the major moral issues that a human being faces. They address all the hot spots of greed, hate, and delusion. They are hard to keep. They're not impossible. They are feared in some traditions and in some countries. They are formidable and revered in others. You should be, and yes, I know what I'm saying, and I'm going to use the word, you should be proud of yourself that you are willing to try to take these precepts. Don't become proud, but you should be very pleased that you have the courage to do it. Because the precepts actually will do what you intend for them to do. And that is, they will enable you to become a Buddha. In Buddhism, as you all know, the commitment to keep the precepts is one that is basically a commitment that one makes to oneself and not to something external. It is not an external agreement. It is not a covenant in the old sense of the word between a human being and an external deity. Yes, it is the case, it is true, that when we take precepts, we usually take them in front of, historically, the Buddha, or the Bodhisattvas, or a great teacher, or if none of these are available, in front of the image of a Buddha. If you read Brahma's Net, there is a teaching about that in one of the minor precepts. But that Buddha, those Bodhisattvas, are there as witnesses. They are witnessing our promise or our vow to live by the precepts. They're not the judge. They're not the jury. There is, in fact, no judge or jury there. There is simply the purity of intention with which we endeavor to keep these precepts. One vows in front of the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, their representative, it may be me at lay ordination, in front of the whole Sangha, to keep these precepts, to live by them. I vow to undertake the rule of training, to teach myself to refrain from killing, stealing, lying, intoxicants, sexual misconduct, being proud of myself and devaluing others, defaming the three treasures, being angry, being miserly. Here I am, I vow to do it. And one of the really wonderful things about our tradition is that it recognizes this is not an easy thing to do. So every 2 weeks, you get to come back and do it again if you want to. This continues to uphold in my mind something that was mentioned at our most recent monastic conference, that in fact monastics who regularly meet to hold precepts meetings are failed lay people. We are people who try to live in the world and who tried to keep precepts in the world, and we failed so miserably, we had to become monks and force ourselves to live in these places and to do it this way. That's a joke. I think it's a little too close to home for some of us. There is an element of truth in it. In terms of daily training, because we are making this vow, there is no judgment, no external judgment for perceptual breakage. There is no agent of judgment. There is simply our own minds. And as we all know, we are the harshest critic we have. We can be our own worst enemy sometimes. But we are simply what we bring to keeping or breaking the precepts is what we bring to it. There is nothing outside of that. Instead of there being no judgment for perceptual breakage, there is simply a ripening of consequence in the form of suffering. And it's really straightforward, and we all know it just by looking at our own minds and our own experiences. To break the precepts is to suffer. Not because it is the precepts per se, but the precepts express that which must be kept or done in order not to suffer. They are very natural in that sense. They already express our nature just as it is before we confuse the issue with our minds and our distorted views. When you really get down there, though, and when you really bite into them, and when you really look at yourself, you realize, if I break these precepts, I suffer. So I'm going to keep them because I don't wish to suffer. Keeping the precepts is a natural functioning of the spiritual law of the Buddha, or if you want, the laws of the universe, the natural order of things, reality, the way it really is. This is what the precepts express. It's the way that it operates whether a Buddha happens to be abiding in it or not. Whether there is a Buddha here in this world, whether there is a bodhisattva that we can see or have faith in or go to, whether there is a great teacher or even a not really very great teacher around. The truth of the precepts still continues to operate, no matter what. And it is, in the long run, much more straightforward and clear what it is that we need to do if we adopt the viewpoint that this is something that I do to harmonize myself with my own Buddha nature, rather than this is something external that I've got to do in order to please so-and-so out there somewhere. Instead, keeping the precepts is the way in which I learn to live in harmony with Buddha nature, with that which is the harmony of this world. This idea of the ripening of consequence and how important that is, you can see in a very current example. It's foremost in my mind because, as I said, I lived through this once and remember even now how scary it was. But at the moment, you know, we're seeing a lot of fires in Southern California. And if you believe in the agency of an external deity, it would be very tempting to view these fires as the way in which this deity is punishing the wicked people of Southern California for all their wicked ways and their mansions and everything else. But you know, a Buddhist is more likely to see an accumulation of causes and circumstances. Possibly some of them moral, but most of them very practical. Oftentimes in those areas, canyons burn. If you build your house in a canyon, it's going to burn. With all the, you know, bark beetles and all the other things that are going on, a ripening of circumstances. Still suffering. But if I put my house in a place like that, I run the risk of having that kind of situation. The fact that we have a monastery that's in the middle of a forest, makes us vulnerable to fire. We've got to be careful of what it is that we do in terms of fire. And indeed, there is no place on this earth that does not have those circumstances and those causes and conditions. It's just a part of life. What happens in the world also happens in the world of the spirit. It is something that is completely natural. If I do something that is going to risk my true nature, my ability to live in harmony with my true nature, I get closer and closer to the fact of suffering. And whereas if I am keeping the precepts to the best of my ability and keeping up the purity of my intention and of my vow to keep those precepts, and I'm actively working to do that, I am much less likely to suffer the catastrophes of spiritual fires and floods. I said in the beginning that part of the founder's vow has to do with Sangha. Sangha, contrition, especially in terms of what we've been talking about with the awakening of faith, because part of the background of the awakening of faith is the Lankavatara Sutra. And in the Lankavatara Sutra, they use the term turning around. Sangha is the turning around that we do, the coming about, the putting the intention, the action, the desire, the wish to put ourselves in harmony with Buddha mind, with our own real nature. This is an act of compassion towards ourselves. It is something that we can do at any time. It is something that we can do at all times. Even if we have become negligent or lazy, even if we are lacking in faith or in trust, even if we have done something which we cannot undo or are deeply ashamed of, we can do Sangha. We can turn around. We can change. We can do it differently. Why is that so? It is because the action of enlightenment, the action of the purity of the intention to become a Buddha, to live in harmony with our own true nature, creates merit. And that merit doesn't just sit there, but it actually works for us. When we call on it, it answers. When we put it to work, it works for us and with us in the deepest possible place within us and for our benefit. Why does it do this? Because great compassion is the source of everything. This is the way that it is. And in spite of the experiences and pain we go through in life, and in spite of the way that samsara, the world of birth and death, appears, great compassion is much deeper and much more benevolent than all of the pain and sorrow. In the Shobogenzo, Dogen wrote about Sangye. If you are lazy or negligent in mind or body, if you are lacking in faith and trust, you should, in all devotion and sincerity, admit this openly before the Buddhas and repent your actions. When we do thus, the strength from the meritorious fruits of repenting before the Buddhas will rescue and cleanse us. These meritorious fruits are the result of our being unencumbered as we live in pure trust and foster an attitude of devotion. Once we have manifested pure trust, both ourselves and others alike turn around. The benefits of this will spread far and wide, encompassing both sentient and non-sentient. The founder's vow is the vow of turning around. And once that vow is made manifest in a place by a person, all beings are enabled to turn around. Because the nature of Buddha nature is to lead all beings to the realization of their true home and true enlightenment and true peace. So when one person turns around, the opportunity is for everyone to turn with them. And this is not something that is confined to time or to space. Over 2,500 years ago, a man in India sat beneath the Bodhi tree, said, "I will not move from this place until I have found my true nature. I'd just as soon die here." His turning is still turning because it is turning us. He was Indra who pointed a blade of grass, and in Mount Shasta, California, a temple sprang up right at the place where he pointed 2,500 years later. Is that not a miracle? And that someone like you or someone like me could be part of that and be helped to turn around is great compassion indeed. And this is the vow of the founder, that all beings, including myself, will be enlightened under this tree, in this country, in this world, in this place. When we do not put anything in the way of that, that vow is unstoppable. It cannot be deflected. It cannot be stopped. It can be put on hold for a little bit, but in fact, it continues to move towards enlightenment, to bring all beings towards it. Regardless of what we have done or not done, simply by calling on the Buddhas and ancestors, by taking refuge in great compassion by being willing to turn around in the middle of confusion and pain enables great compassion to help us. Dogen said, even though the wicked deeds that I have done in the past have piled up deep and cause obstructions to my training in the way, I pray that all the Buddhas and ancestors who have realized the truth in accordance with the Buddha's way will have pity on me. Help me to let go of my karmic entanglements. Help me dissipate any impediments to training in the way. May they help the gateway to the inexhaustible Dharma ceaselessly pour forth its meritorious fruits, to permeate the whole universe so that the compassionate pity of the teachings will spread to all of us. There are people who feel that this idea of a external deity is in fact what Buddhism does teach when it talks about the Buddhas and ancestors. But the Buddhas and ancestors are not out there. They are in here. They are in you. They are in me. They are in all of us. We are in them. The purity of the intention with which we look at our actions of body, speech, and mind, that is what turns us around and teaches us to want to keep precepts. Again, it's how we are doing it that is the important thing. Not that we do it perfectly at every moment, but how we are going to do it. The purity of our intention, the quality of the vow, the depth with which we make the resolve. Not that we fall down 999 times, but that we get up 1,000. How does one keep precepts? How is it that we look? We actually all know that. We know how to do it. We do it when we meditate because we are letting go. Letting go, not holding on to things, not pushing them away. Just watching them arise, seeing them, not bringing the judge and jury to view them, but just looking and letting go, letting them flow through, seeing them, noticing them, acknowledging them, whatever these actions may be, actions of body, actions of speech, actions of mind. This is the stillness and the mindfulness that we talk about. I mentioned the non-judgmentalism, no judge and jury, no conditions placed on whatever it is that is arising, other than to see its cause and its consequence. You know, look at this. This is what happens. Direct connection. If you don't see it, keep looking. You'll see it. Compassion, which is really accepting things just as they are, just as they appear. Not changing, not altering, not window dressing, not making them worse, seeing them just as they are. Non-duality. Non-duality is the way in which the Kyoju Kaimon is read. You look at the, you know, those 10 fearsome precepts. That precept number 3 on coveting, which addresses directly the nature of desire. We're all in trouble when it comes to desire. Because it's really hard not to hold on to at least one of them, just a little. The doer, the doing, and that which has the doing done to it are immaculate. Non-duality. That's what it means. And finally, the immaculacy and the emptiness of the things that arise. Last night, we took all of our stuff, all of our karma, threw it in the Sagaki Toro, and set light to it. And here you have all this substantial stuff, which we feel is so very important. Everything I call me. And I put it in this place, and I set light to it with the fire of training, or with my intention to turn around and to keep the precepts. I actualize the founder's vow. I too am going to do this. And what happens? Well, this stuff just blazes. And it gets really hot, and it hurts, and it smokes, and then it fades into nothing. And it's this insubstantial ash that blows away in the wind, or that is finer than dirt when combined with it. That is what we are. And within that, that seeming loss or emptiness, there is a purity and an immaculacy that is beyond our comprehension, which we actualize and manifest when we turn around and make the attempt to keep the precepts. These aspects of mind, the how we keep them, all come back to the same thing, which is both the method and the goal, if you want to use that word, of the training. It is that purity of intention, the founder's vow. Or if you want to use another word, love. Unconditional love. The kind of love that reaches into the depths in darkness and never flinches, because it is all compassionate and is that which rescues both ourselves and all beings. And it comes from within. And it goes within. The kind of love that can embrace anything, look at anything, and transform anything, because of its purity and because of its unconditionedness. You can call it love. You can call it purity. You can call it emptiness. Just call on it. This is the compassion of the unborn. It is the founder's vow. It is not necessarily the compassion of human beings at every moment, because we, through our ignorance, limit our compassion. Nevertheless, we too are capable of manifesting it. And the turning around and the purity of intention is what enables and actualizes that. The vow to turn around, to keep the precepts, is the setting up of the Bodhimanda and the Bodhimandala inside of ourselves. The training of Buddhas and ancestors is our training. The vow of the founder, of what created this place, that's our vow. Turning around what we call Sangha, that is the intention through which an ordinary person becomes a Buddha. The precepts are the action of body, speech, and mind when that intention is actualized, is manifested, is practiced. They are the behavior exhibited by an ordinary person who is becoming a Buddha. That is what the keeping of the precepts is. It is how a Buddha behaves. It is how a Buddhist behaves. It is how we aspire to behave in body, speech, and mind. It is the purity of intention with which we try to do that. And that is the founder's vow. And that is our vow. May you all be well and happy. Happy Founders Day.